Hi everybody, and welcome to another Turned Up interview. And as always, we're so appreciative of the artists that take time to speak to us here in the show. And not alone that, every interview is unique because everybody has a different story to tell. And certainly the story you're about to hear tonight is certainly one that this is really like a tapestry. There's so many different beautiful parts to it. And I'm not going to waste any time. I'm actually going to introduce you to someone that I've come to know extremely well. This is a really good guy. He takes everything he does so seriously and puts 110% into it. And I know you're going to enjoy hearing the story of Jim Bazinet. Jim, you're so welcome to the Turned Up interview.
You know something, you said it perfectly well, and I'm extremely flattered. You do a great show, Jerry, and I'm really, really happy and proud to be on your show, and I'm real happy to share my story with you.
Well, I suppose we have to tell the listeners you're from Seattle, and you know, once you talk about Seattle, Seattle's famous for a lot of people, Jimi Hendrix and Kurt Cobain that just come to mind. So you're really coming from an area where the stock of music is pretty high. But you know what I do with most people, Jim? I ask them, you know, go right back. When did you get your first inkling that you wanted to do this in music? What was your first inspiration? Was it something you saw? What happened? So just tell the listeners, for Jim Bazinet, how did you start your interest in music, your journey in music?
Well, you know something, it was kind of like, as far as it being like a first inspiration that really changed everything, I think it was more like just chipping away at it until finally the dam burst, as it were. My first exposures to music when I was a little boy was seeing the Beatles on television, but I wasn't that interested. I was more interested in changing the channel to, you know, Disney or something like that. And, you know, all the big girls who at that point were like 12 and 13 and things like that were all excited about the Beatles. But it was this kind of, gradually I became really interested in the Beatles. I got my first Beatles record after my dad took me to see the movie Help when I was a little kid. And I finally go, whoa, this is pretty cool. And I started listening to their music. And this was before I had a radio, so I really wasn't that tuned in what was going on in the top 50 and all that stuff. But I got my first radio and I started listening to the music and I really got into the Beatles. My dad bought me a copy of Revolver and he bought me Absolutely Free by the Mothers. My dad was a unique cat. And he also bought me an album by the Fugs, which was a kind of a counterculture band from New York City at the time. And we were living in Seattle, but my mom's from New York. So we had lived in New York earlier in the decade and such. So, we had kind of a mixture of a lot of influences. But, you know, mainly I got into that. I was starting to listen to that. I started listening to records and became very excited about the new British bands that were coming out and stuff like, Van Morrison, them. It was my first single that I actually tried to figure out on the guitar. That was Gloria. And then as beyond that, I loved the Kinks and all that stuff, the Who, and of course the Rolling Stones were as big as can be, and you know, and then the Beatles were still, of course, and on and on and so it was the British stuff, and then Jimi Hendrix came along, and I was really excited about that. And I think he brought up the Northwest, and that was always important to me, and I really identify with him as well as Paul Revere and the Raiders, who are from the Northwest and were on TV and stuff like that. So I kind of saw them as being more interesting because they were from the area. And so I'd say Jimi Hendrix was my first real idol that I really focused on and really got interested in heavily. But I really couldn't play as well as him. I tried to figure out a couple of his songs. So I did a couple of his tunes like Purple Haze and Foxy Lady to the best of my ability with the guitar. I started playing the guitar and I learned some Bob Dylan songs and so on and so forth. So that was kind of an avocation for me. My focus, my dad and my grandfather kind of convinced me that I was going to be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. And I was really good in school, good grades. And so I was playing on the chess team and playing basketball, the basketball team and all this kinds of stuff. So I was real busy. with all that stuff, but I just still remain interested in music as sort of a side thing. Some boys walked away, I play a guitar in the neighborhood and begged me. One guy even threatened me that he's going to beat me up if I didn't play in his band because they needed a singer, and so whatever. But the bottom line is, you know, I just was focused on other things, and I was listening to music as a, you know, interest, as an interest. And then I was collecting records, and as I got old enough to go to record stores by myself, I started buying lots and lots of records. And then, you know, the long and short of it was that at one point I really, really got into music, and that was really the glam rock thing. I really started getting into all that stuff to where I was seeing myself being in a band. The first one I really got into was T-Rex, and then David Bowie, and then from David Bowie, Iggy and Lou Reed, the bands that he produced, and Slade. And then I really liked them. And then the New York Dolls came out, and that was a major, major thing for me. And I just, because I saw in Johnny Thunders, as opposed to a guy like Jimi Hendrix, someone that I could play like that real easily and really get into it. I could see myself. Same with Lou Reed with the vocals. It was like, I could sing like him without a problem. I couldn't sing with these guys that had these huge five octave ranges or whatever, but I could sure sing and deliver a song like Lou Reed. So I saw myself in these artists, and that was pretty much the end of it. At that point, I became completely focused on being in a band and being a musician for the rest of my life. At that point, I'd say that was about probably 1970.
So then if we kind of move forward then a few years to what I would call, I suppose, your first, will we call it professional band, the Mobileys, yes. I mean, that was yes. Kind of around the late 70s, so maybe a bit about how that happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, I started playing in a couple different bands. I tried working in bands that played teen dances and things like that, but I started a band of all glam covers that was sort of that, and we played the talent show at my high school when I was a senior in 1975 and created a big stir, put silver paint on my, I went shirtless and with silver paint on my chest, kind of like Iggy Pop, and I drew a big black X on my chest with charcoal and all over my face and everything else. I was silver and all this, and so, you know, it was kind of a shock for a lot of the people that knew me from the chess club and from the basketball team and from the honors math and stuff like that, and most of them were open-minded and happy about it, but I remember having some problems with some of the jocks, as it were. But at any rate, so I did that and that band, and that kind of caused a little scene. And then that band split off into a couple of bands that were original bands, and one of them was the Mice, and that was my band with the guitar player from that band, Paul. And then we formed with another guy who had a little fanzine called Chatterbox, of course, which was the name for that Johnny Thunders song from the New York Dolls. And we had this little fanzine too, as well as a band called the Mice, and we interview bands. And we interviewed Rory Gallagher, as a matter of fact, over there, and I met a lot of people on the way, and you know, Lou Reed and Queen and a bunch of other cool bands we interviewed. We were lucky to get in with some of the local record companies would give us you know, promos and tickets and backstage passes to interview. We had this little band scene that was distributed a lot amongst the kids in our neighborhood in the U District. But so that was cool. And then as that grew, we did our first show with the Mice, that was with the Tupperwares and the Telepaths, these other bands that were, one of them was an offshoot of the Lover Boys, was that band I was in with the glam covers. And then another one was some guys who had been to New York City and put together a kind of a band that was, you know, sort of one of the early punk bands. And they moved down to L.A. and became the Screamers, which was one of the first punk bands in L.A. In fact, we did this show on May 1st, 1976, which was the first do-it-yourself punk show on the West Coast. And it was also predated the first do-it-yourself punk show in the U.K. by 1 week as well. So we were kind of early on in the punk thing. And then and doing that, and then we worked together for about a year, played shows. We couldn't really play in the clubs because that was all cover bands and stuff. We just played self-promoted shows and things. And the last show we did was opening for the Ramones, and that was on March 6th, 1977. And that was the first time the Ramones played in town, and that was the first a kind of punk show from a national touring band in Seattle. And so we were kind of on the beginning of the history of the scene. And then at that point, I decided to move to New York City. I moved to New York for 6 months and really learned a lot about the music business and saw tons of great bands and was very fortunate to be hosted by people that I met through the Ramones and some of their staff and things. But I decided not to stay there. I came back to Seattle, put out a single, which was one of the first independent singles in the Seattle area in late 1977, early 1978. And that was a big deal and got me a lot of local press and some national mentions. And then from that, the Moberlys were put together. Was the name that I came up with that I felt was appropriate to my music. And because it was kind of reminded me kind of like the Everlys and, you know, Ramones and those kinds of names. And so, we did that and we started the Moberlys, and that was a band that lasted from 1978 until 1989, and three different major lineup changes. We worked together. That version of the band was together for about a year and a half and then put out an album, which was one of the first albums of local kind of punk new wave in Seattle area. And that album got me some national attention. It was a number three underground record of the year in Trouser Press magazine, which was a pretty big thing for back then. It was way before the internet. And so there was very limited amount of, space for non-major label stuff to get, national, international exposure. So that was a big deal. And then I moved to New York City in late 1980 and lived there for 3.5 years, did a lot of stuff there. Put together another version of the Moberlys because obviously that band kind of didn't want to move to New York with me, but I wanted to, and that's what I did. So I put together a band there called the Moberlys, and we played around New York City and did a lot of stuff there, and that's where I saw Johnny Thunders quite a bit and sort of got to know him and a number of other people in his circle, and also some other artists. Alan Vega from the band Suicide I became good friends with, and his girlfriend at that time played in her band, and I later got married, and we were together for a short while, unfortunately, but she was wonderful. But that was later on when I moved to LA, but I was living in New York for a few years and did a lot of stuff there, and came close to getting that major record label deal, but did some great recordings and played with some great bands and opened for some great acts like Billy Idol and Smithereens and quite a few others, the Romantics, quite a few others. And so then I moved back to Seattle with some guys that came out, with one guy that came out to play with me in New York, and we formed another third version of the Moberlys, and that was the one that lasted the longest. We formed that in early 84, and we were playing around the Seattle area and did pretty well in the Seattle area for about a year and a half, and then moved to L.A. And then we stayed together in L.A., did a bunch of things there, became very close. Well, we actually got a record deal with EMI Records, EMI America. And then halfway through the production of the record with Peter Buck from REM producing it, we actually recorded 8 songs, so I guess it'd be more than halfway through it. And we recorded tons and tons of other demos and things with other producers and stuff that I ended up being able to own later, which is great because I put them out. And then the label sold to another label and decided to really change direction and got rid of pretty much, not just us, but about 30 rock and roll bands. And they decided they wanted to go for more of the dance kind of thing. And so that's what they were doing as far as new pop and things, except for a couple of exceptions like David Bowie and Brian Setzer. So that's what we kind of got flushed out of that. And then we were looking for other record deals and got some big time management behind us and all kinds of things. But unfortunately, the LA, kind of grind ended up us not getting anything really that great. And the band kind of lost sort of interest. And I think the band was interested, but the band sort of lost hope and kind of decided to go our different ways. And so I put together a band with some other guys that were pretty well established. Guy had been in Concrete Blonde, which was a big band over in the United States. I'm not sure if you know about them. They had a couple of hits. Another guy who had been with Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction, right before he was replaced by the guy who they became Jane's Addiction when he was replaced. They had a band called Psycom, and then he was replaced by Dave Navarro. And so that was he was a really good guitar player, Kelly Wheeler. And then another guy who has been friends of mine for many years in New York, Mike Cechi, and the bass player from Concrete Blonde was Al Block. And we put together a band and played around L.A. and also came pretty close to getting signed. I got a lot of good press, and so just kind of a lot of just real close calls with a lot of really good stuff had sort of happened in my career, and it was kind of discouraging, but.
Yeah. You
know, bottom line was that I cared a lot more about the music than I really cared about a lot of that stuff. So it didn't stop me like it stopped a lot of other people.
No, you seem to have been very prolific in that, you know, you never stood still. You know, you were always trying to have ongoing collaborations with different people. Now, I suppose there's a number of aspects to your career, and certainly you've had a very busy one. You know, we're going to talk about a few of them. We're going to talk about your association with Johnny Thunders. We're going to talk about the biography you did of Sonny Boy Williamson and some of your later music and the future projects. We will touch on all of that. But I suppose we've mentioned Johnny Thunders' name a few times. And maybe just to hone a little bit on that, how did you come to be in the band? How did that come about? You said you're in the scene in the area or whatever, but I presume there was a meeting, there was something happened that brought you to work with Johnny.
Yes, absolutely. In 1982, he was kind of between bass players, and I was living in Daily Planet building, which was a rehearsal studio building. The gal that I was saying was Alan Vega's girlfriend, in sleeping in her studio loft on the floor. And the drummer from the Moberlys was this guy, Dave Drury, the late Dave Drury, was there with Al Block, who I later put together that band, The Skyscrapers, with, and we were playing with a guy from New York that I'd been playing with, Jeremy Barlon. But the three of us, me and Dave and Al, had been doing, you know, a lot of Johnny Thunders covers and sort of a tribute to Johnny Thunders just for fun, because I'd been watching so many of his gigs and gotten to know the people in his band and the people around him and him to some degree. He's a very unique character. It's kind of hard to know whether he knows you or not, but I'd talked to him a few times and hung out with him. And so we were playing this, the music, and I had got to know the late Billy Rogers. Was a drummer he was working with more often than not. Him and Jerry Nolan weren't working together that often. And so, you know, at one point, those guys, Billy and Johnny Thunders, asked me, because they needed a bass player to fill in, they asked me to come play. And so I went upstairs to where they were at, and it was just Billy and me and Johnny. We ran through a bunch of the tunes, and Johnny was pretty amazed how well I know the material. Billy and his guitar player or bass player at that time, Luigi, had heard us. I think Tony C, had heard us just jamming away in the rehearsal studio, and they thought that Johnny was in there. So they were pretty impressed with the way that we sounded doing the tunes. So he called me up to play bass. I came up and played bass, and we did this really long rehearsal, and Jimmy Miller was there, the guy that produced the Stones, and he was checking things out. And then another guy who was booking Johnny, trying to book Johnny maybe for a tour of South America, came and with his wife and watched us. So it was kind of this long kind of marathon, 4 or 5 hour rehearsal. It seemed like at least 3 hours. And then from there, you know, I just kind of started talking to Johnny around the area where I was living there. And he we talked about doing a bunch of dates and things like that. I got together with him and jammed on the acoustic guitar. And that was really great. And just hanging around the building and backed him up on a couple of his acoustic songs and things like that, and ran through a bunch of covers and things like that. I really never played much with Guy as far as that goes. Like he called me, he called me up a bunch of times. Unfortunately, I got an apartment I was living in, and I had a phone, but he called and tried to reach me, and we never really connected on doing dates. I got to know him, kind of hung out with him, but the guy guy that I'm working with on this project, Luigi, actually, I also did another gig. I did another gig with Johnny where he came up. I was invited to play with the Mobleys. Were invited to play for his 30th birthday party, and we played with him and did a couple of his songs in tribute. And then he came out and did a set with the band that we were playing, which was called Just in Trouble. Justin was an old friend of his from Queens, and he got up with them and played a mini set. I think it was about probably 5-6 songs. With them for his birthday, and then I just saw him around a lot and hung out with him a lot, and there was a lot of talk about me playing with him, but we really never did a lot of gigs, but we never did anything actually formally. But but Luigi, the guy that I'm talking to bringing over to Europe to do a Johnny Thunders tribute, he's one of the few people left alive that played with Johnny, and he was in that band with Tony C and Billy Rogers that was sort of the band Johnny was using when the Heartbreakers were pretty much kind of iffy at best. And that was in the early 80s, from probably about 80, late 80, early 81 to about 84. I think that pretty much lasted. But he played with those guys off and on for a while after that, but mostly he was playing with European guys and touring and things. But that was pretty much it. But Luigi played with them a lot, and he's, as far as the people from New York, the only people alive really that play with Johnny consistently are David Johansen from the Dolls. Richard Hell played with him for a short time in the Heartbreakers, and he's still alive. And then this guy, because Walter Lure's gone, Billy Rapp gone, Jerry Nolan gone, Luigi Scorcia, he played with him a lot. And I guess there's people that played with him after, when he was mostly based in Europe. And hopefully we'll meet some of them when we go over there and play. But he's the only one left, pretty much. And so he's playing. And so that's pretty much the story as far as Johnny Thunders. That's the complete story.
Okay. Well, look, that's really cool, and it's very interesting. Now we're going to change the aspect a bit, because you did a biography on Sonny Boy Williamson. So again, yes, that's a bit of a change. This is a blues man, you know, completely different. How did you become involved in that? And what was the process like? How did it affect your music? Did it relate to your music? How did it affect it? How did that happen?
I'll tell you, that's a great question. You ask great questions, Jerry. You really do, and you're very intuitive. And I appreciate you doing a great job. I was going to say, and I've been in your shoes before, being a person that's interviewed about 100-something people for the Sonny Boy Williamson research. What happened to me with Sonny Boy Williamson was I didn't really know much about Sonny Boy growing up. I had the Sonny Boy and the Yardbirds and the Sonny Boy and the Animals records. But I didn't think it was that good. And as time has gone on, I realized that those were probably the worst records he ever did, to be perfectly honest. He played with a lot of really greats from the blues. And those guys were, you know, wanted to be blues players when they were young. And both of them had good qualities that went well to doing a blues record, in a sense, with a master like Sonny Boy. But they weren't the kind of records that he made with some of the others from Chicago and from the Mississippi Delta and so on and so forth. And when he went over to Europe and recorded with those people over in Denmark and such, in Germany. And you know, so those were, I wasn't that interested. And then as time went on, I got hired in 1994 to write a musical, to co-compose a musical with some folks, a guy from New York who was had done a lot of work with Bill Cosby and PBS and such as that. I wrote the script. It was called Little Rock. It was about integration in the Deep South in the late 50s. And another guy who was local, who was a musical theater expert, kind of musical director. So the three of us wrote these songs for this musical. And I was just doing a lot of research on the music of the 50s. I was researching the blues heavily, because it was heavily a part of the fabric of what was going on and the basis of all that was going on with rock and roll and R&B and everything, and then rockabilly. And then also I was listening to a lot of rockabilly, and I was listening to quite a bit of sort of 50s pop at the time, you know, just all the pop records that were happening then and such. And so I brought that influence into this production. And one of the people I started listening to through this Rhino series called Blues Masters that really was remarkable, I thought, was Sonny Boy Williamson too, also known as Alex Miller, or is gone by Rice Miller, but he rarely used that name in his life after the age of 25. But the long and short of it is that I became interested in Sonny Boy, and I really liked him and started buying all his records and really getting into him as just musically, because that was one of the ones I really loved. Of course, I loved Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and some of the other greats, and just very tons of them. You know, I got turned on to all that music through that experience. The Robert Nighthawk and so on and so forth, with Jimmy Rogers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I was interested in that stuff, but just as a fan and playing gigs and such as that. And I ran across this guy and his bride-to-be, and they were telling me, he told me he interviewed all these people and was doing a Sonny Boy Williamson documentary, and I was impressed. And so he was kind of a wine connoisseur. He invited me over for dinner and sat and drank wine. He played me all these films of Sonny Boy that he had. Of course, this was before the internet, where he had YouTube, and a lot of the stuff was on YouTube. And I was just blown away by his technique and by his style. All the films were ones that were done in Europe when he was a rather old man and kind of destroyed from alcohol and such. But it was real impressive. And so, you know, I got interested in, you know, we talked about me helping him with the thing, but he was kind of interested in doing it, but he was also, he had a big business going with his financial management company and all this stuff like that. So it was kind of a hobby thing for him. But, you know, he talked about finishing this up and making this documentary, and it never really went anywhere because he was always doing other stuff and whatever. And I was real busy at the time, so I never really pursued it. But he came back to me almost 10 years later, and he hadn't really done anything with it other than collect things and things like that. He hadn't really done any significant interviews or filmed interviews or anything like that that he had put together before. And he started doing filmed interviews in about 95 with Sonny Boy's two remaining siblings, his two sisters that were still alive then. And he got a lot of other great things, like Junior Wells and all kinds of cool stuff, B.B. King. Excuse me. And so he asked me if I could help him finish this, because he'd gotten the financing together where he could really pay me and hire me to do it, because he was also getting rather sickly and I'm not doing too well health-wise, and really couldn't do it himself, couldn't go out and do more interviews or do much. He was kind of almost in a wheelchair at that time. And so I agreed to do it. I needed extra income at that point because I had a family going and things like that, and it made sense for me to have a second income besides playing gigs. So I took the job, and at the same time, we worked out a partnership where he was paying me to do the work, but at the same time, we were doing it as a creative partnership to finish this thing, you know, to do it together creatively. So I did that with him, and we started working on that in early 2012, and his health was always kind of an issue. He had a variety of health issues, and it kind of slowed the thing down. He always wanted to be sort of engaged with it, but the same, he really couldn't focus on stuff because he was always having health issues and going to the hospital and doing all kinds of weird stuff. But unfortunately, he was a very nice guy. But at any rate, he passed away in early 2017, and we had spent a lot of time putting a lot of stuff together. I'd done a lot of interviews, flown all over. Done quite a few interviews over in Europe via Skype with the help of really great people over there, in the UK and in Germany and Scandinavia. And so, I just basically put that together and had it ready to go, and then he passed away. I got one of the greatest experts in the blues, Jim O'Neill, who co-founded Living Blues Magazine, to go through it and fact check it and give us, you know, do a real kind of a full take on the whole thing. And we're ready to make all the corrections and publish it. And then this man, his name was Bill Donahue, passed away. And then it was about a year I was kind of dealing with his family and his estate, and they were fighting with me about who owned it and all this other garbage. And
I know.
So, but we got through that whole thing, and I had to, you know, figure out what I could do
to do my own book of Sonny Boy, and I did started working on that, but I also need to find funding. And I finally found funding to do this in January of 2020. And then, of course, COVID hit, and it was a good combination of having time to really focus on it and also the funding to do so. In light of losing practically every live gig I had available for a year or so still, you know. And so I focused on this and really used a lot of my creative energy to do this. And so I wrote this book, and at the same time, I was in the process of, in the time from when the Sonny Boy research kind of got cut off as far as the funding, I put a lot of energy and time into writing new material, and producing a new album, Not Changing, which came out in July of 2019. And that really got me going on a lot of fronts, including getting quite a bit of airplay over in the UK and Ireland and all over the world, essentially. That really kind of opened my career up in a big way again. And so I put my time to good use over the course of the COVID crisis and engaged a lot of people in radio and the media and gotten a lot of good results and really a tremendous amount of airplay and such. And so it's kind of led to me connecting with you.
Yeah, and then I suppose...
And for W1 and going out to... heading over to Europe to play.
Yeah, and we will talk about that in a minute. I suppose, too, it's worth mentioning that towards the end of 2020, you come out with an album, Joker's Idol, Misfits, which is really a series of covers of some very well-known songs. And in fact, that's how my association with you started, because I picked up on that album on Bandcamp. And I played some of the songs, and there was one particular song, I've told you this before, the Brother Louie song, Hutch, I really liked that, and a whole lot of other rock and roll cowboy, and I've played your music on the show, and that for me was the, and I know there were somebody else's songs, but you done them extremely well and put your own twist on them. And sometimes, you see, in a way, when you do... another song is pretty famous and you put your own stamp on it, you're able to judge it by that, because you can judge it against the original and you can say, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's not because I don't ever believe in someone doing exactly a carbon copy. There has to be some element of organic growth to the song that has changed it a bit, that it's still an original song, but it's actually originality has been, its DNA has been altered a bit. It may be called the same song, but it now is new DNA introduced, and I think that's what you are good at doing. You're good at maybe adding some DNA into the song to just make it a bit different and add a bit of excitement into it, and that's where I first really connected with you, as you know.
Well, you know something, you bring up a really good point, and that's why my persistence in being a musician, which is how we started this conversation, even though I kind of had problems with getting that big break and that big huge deal. I mean, I've sold some records over there. I sold about 15,000 copies of the album I put out in France in 1985 with the Moberlys and stuff, and a lot of other things of mine have done pretty well in the media and stuff, but I've never had that big hit and that big major label deal. But what happened to me is that I just basically decided to play music for a living regardless, which I luckily have been able to do in the Seattle area since I moved back from LA in 1992. So I've been playing music for a living since then. And I've done some side things, like I mentioned, the Sonny Boy thing and a couple other things, some music booking and some other journalistic stuff in sports, actually. But the long and short of it is I've always stuck pretty much close to the music. And one facet of that is actually going out and working as a musician in a large area. I mean, the area of the Northwest is in the United States is huge geographically. So traveling between, you know, Seattle and Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and Utah and Oregon and all these states, you know, it's a huge geographical area. It's basically the same area as like New York, Chicago, down into Carolinas and stuff. So working all these areas and just playing for all these people in all these different towns, small and large, and resorts and every place else to make a living, casinos and colleges and everything. You learn to play cover tunes and you learn to do something with them that you give them of yourself, because if you don't, it, for number one, it bores you to death, and number two, why should anybody see you when they can, you know, see somebody else? So you give it your own thing, I love doing medleys where I kind of put songs together and kind of do things like that, you know. And so just kind of putting together a show over the course of just making a living and having to pay bills, you know, I really learned to embrace playing covers, as well as always being doing more originals than just about every other act that plays the venues I was playing. So I was always playing the originals and promoting my albums, which, of course, you know, now I have 9 albums, including Joker's, and not changing, but I had, you know, 7 before then. So I've been, and then 6 actually when I was first started even doing that, which was when I started doing that kind of traveling, was about 2000, or around thereabouts. So yeah, I mean, it was just by working and learning to play and playing for people, basically. And you learn to engage people, you learn to give it of yourself and connect with them on songs that they like. And I mean, I learned to play quite a bit of country songs, but I always loved to play the old country stuff, like Waylon and Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash and Hank Williams Sr. and Buck Owens and all that great stuff. So Roger Miller and all that. And so, you know, basically I did that, and then I also learned to play a lot of blues. And of course, I already had that in my hip pocket from my love of the blues, and then played a lot of just rock and roll from, depending on the age group who I was playing for, from the 50s through the 90s. And really learned to embrace pretty much all those eras. So it's something that just come to me. And so that album was maybe a culmination of that experience and just how much I love playing with. And I was just fortunate, so fortunate over time to work with so many different musicians and so many great people. So I have a lot of good people to draw from to make that album. You know, the players, I mean, I would never be able to make a record like Brother Louie without the people that were on that record, who really understood how to sound like, you know, the music of the early 70s, and
yeah,
and you know, artists like Curtis Mayfield and Isaac Hayes, and just those great records, and that's kind of what we were going for, and I think we kind of got it. Got a violin player that's fantastic, who I played with a lot of years, and created a string section like you'd hear in a Philadelphia record or a Curtis Mayfield record or something like that. I mean, just that stuff isn't easy to do, and that's what we captured in that song.
Yeah, I suppose moving on, and that, I suppose the thing is that, you know, your previous experience, you know, playing with all these different people, it is, you become a sponge and you soak up all the different influences, and that's so true. But we're going to take you now right through 2020, now up to the present day in 2021. Yeah. And as the people know on the radio show, I wear a number of hats. I don't produce, Colm does that. I present this amazing show here on Radio Home of Rock, which I so love doing. I do some work with making a scene, and I'm also involved with 4W1, and that's where we actually now also have a work relationship there with myself and the rest of the people there. And we have looked at a project that again connects us with Johnny Thunders. And well, you and I had a chat not so long ago, and we can maybe now share with the listeners what those plans are.
Well, you know something, we're planning to come over to Europe and do a tribute to Johnny Thunders. We have a name that we're looking at of using that I really love, Johnny Thunders Jubilee, which I think is very catchy. There's still some other talk about maybe some other names, but we'll see what ends up. But the upshot of it would be myself, Luigi, who's real good, who could be playing guitar and bass, and which he did with Johnny as well. So he doesn't have to change anything he's doing, because he's doing exactly what he was doing in the early 80s. You know, many, many times I saw him play doing that. So, and then Michael Rollins, who plays in my band, as a matter of fact, he played on that Brother Louie. He played bass on that Brother Louie track. And he'll be playing bass, but he also is a sax player. He plays saxophone a lot on a lot of different recordings of mine, and flute as well. He's also a harmonica player too. And so he'll be playing those instruments You know, probably mostly sax, because Johnny didn't really work with the flute that much. He worked with the harmonica and the New York Dolls, of course. But, you know, and then he'll be playing that while Luigi plays bass on a certain number of tracks. And then the drummer is a guy who plays in my band also. His name is Sean Peabody. And he's a guy who has been in army bands for the last 15 years, leading and working in army bands while he was in the military and did a tour of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan and all that crazy stuff. But he mainly has been a musician for all that time in the Army, which is really great because he's a solid, solid pro. And so he'll be doing Jerry Nolan, and he's really relishing the prospect of playing all the Jerry Nolan, great Jerry Nolan stuff from the Dolls and from the Heartbreakers and from Johnny's solo career and stuff. So, so that's going to be exciting, and we're going to come out as a four piece and just basically rock. Johnny Thunders, the legend of Johnny Thunders, the story of Johnny Thunders is a tremendous one that it, with time, just keeps on getting more important. I mean, his music was so influential, and his sound was so influential on punk rock, as they call it, in the late 70s, on the whole glam rock thing that happened in the 80s. In general, in American rock and roll, he's one of the more important figures in modern rock, truthfully, and yet to really been recognized. He got so much bad press and received so much kind of negative vibe from the music industry in America, which I can relate to, not as much as he got, but pretty bad. The long and short of it is that we're out there playing. We're going to come out and play, and lock up your daughters. I'm just kidding.
It sounds really exciting. Yeah, lock up your daughters indeed. It sounds really exciting. I'm certainly, as far as I'm concerned, looking forward. I'm delighted to be a part of all of this because, as you know about me, music's my passion too. So to link together with like-minded, passionate people is really great. Now, I suppose we're getting towards the end of the interview, and one of the things I like to do is we play some tracks. We'll play a track before this interview button is pressed, and then we'll play some more during it. Now, I'm looking at the time of the interview here. We may be splitting this into a two-parter. If that's the case, then we need 8 picks. So I think I nearly assume it is going to be a two-part. I think at the minute it will be. So what would we kick it off with then? What would be the first song to kick it off with?
Well, you know, I'd like to kick it off really is the song that's going to be my next single on the Big Stir label. It's coming out June 11th, and that's Middle of the Night. And that's going to be something new that hasn't been pushed out there digitally at all. So it's brand new in the sense of people who are fans of my music from digital media. And so that would be a good one to kick it off. So that would be, and I think there's definitely a Johnny Thunders influence in that song too. I was going to say one more thing about Johnny Thunders too. We're going to be doing songs from his entire career, from the New York Dolls to the Heartbreakers to his solo stuff in sort of the middle of era, like In Cold Blood and the Hurt Me album and all that great stuff in the 80s, and then also the late 80s stuff. And he of course passed away in 91. It was some of the real cool songs from that later period, like Some Hearts and Society Makes Me Sad and all that kind of stuff that are really heavily featuring the sax. So we're really covering a wide variety of his stuff, but it's going to be, it's just, I'm really excited about that too. And go ahead and play us play us some rock and roll.
Yeah, so we kick off with Middle of the Night. That's going to be the new single out on June 11th. What will we go with next then?
Well, how about the other ones I gave you, I would say if you can play Rock and Roll Cowboy, that's a real good one. Got the little F-bomb in there. I don't know if that's going to matter. Also, I would say to do one from Not Changing. There's so many good ones there to go with. I would go with either Code to Live By or Making Love for a Living. But there's a lot of them that are there that are good. I'm not sure what else. Is that going to be enough, do you think? Rebel Kind is a really good one too. Off of Joker's, obviously, Brother Louie would be good. Rebel Kind is going to be the flip side of that of Middle of the Night single as well too. So that would be good. Either way, I'm up to you. Whatever you want to play too.
That's okay. Maybe we'll leave the rest a surprise there. That we have a number of suggestions there, and that's really good. Jim,
thank you.
You know, it's always lovely to speak to someone like yourself because you can hear it. You know, your passion, your enthusiasm for this is just it's really there for everyone to hear. You know, you're like a sponge. You've soaked up so many influences. You know, it comes out in your music, comes out in your songs, your playing. And I, for one, I'm really, really excited to see this new show, Johnny Thunder's Jubilee, if that's the final name, when it comes to Europe. I know it's going to be something really special. And I know there are many, many, many Johnny Thunder fans out there that will be almost teary-eyed to see something like this again. And I commend you for doing this, for putting it together. And certainly wearing my other hat as one of the people in 4W1. We're so proud and happy to have you with us here on our journey, because it's people like you that, you know, we all dream. It's our dream too, and we want to do it together. And that's the difference with what we are doing. We're a family. We're a team. And we do this because we love it. And on behalf of myself, Colin, the station here, Radio Home of Rock, the show, Torn It Up, it's just an absolute pleasure to speak to you on this interview. And, you know, I only can wish you well. And I know that that's going to happen. And, you know, the COVID situation, it held everything back. But, you know, I think we're coming out the other side, and we're looking forward to many happy nights of celebrating some great music. So, Jim, thank you so much for doing the Torn Up interview. It's been an absolute pleasure, and looking forward to meeting you in person in the near future.
I have one other thing to say. Also, I have an album coming out on vinyl, which I'm excited on the Danger House label in France, of the Joker's album. So it's going to be 12 songs. Of course, it can't be as long as the Joker CD, but it's going to be absolutely fantastic. The pressing is wonderful. That's coming out in late July or early August, just depending on the pressing plant. But that's going to be exciting too, and that's going to weigh into things. And I know that we're going to be playing, because I'm bringing over two guys from my band. I know that we're going to probably be playing some Jim Bastenite gigs while we're over there doing the Johnny Thunders thing as well, just to let you know.
Yeah, listen.
I'm sure you already do.
I think so. Listen, Kavir, again, you know, as I say, looking forward to that vinyl release as well. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure. Once again, thank you so much for coming on the show and doing the Torn Up interview.
Thank you for listening to my long-winded answers, but I'm really happy to be here, so hopefully that makes up for it.
It sure does. It's a pleasure to listen to someone with so much passion. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you so much. Take care.